I'm Nicole.
And I'm Brandon, and this is Spectrum Sessions,
where we talk about all things like diagnosis. We're also therapists and come at this with not only personal experience, but clinical experience as well.
Hey, welcome back to Spectrum Sessions. In today's episode, we're going to be exploring ADHD and autism. We're going to have two guests to highlight the unique experiences and perspectives of the neurodiverse community. Whether you're here to better understand yourself, support others, or challenge the misconceptions around ADHD and autism, you are in the right place. Let's celebrate neurodiversity and learn how we can all live more authentically and inclusively.
According to the scientific literature, 50 to 70% of individuals with autism also present with comorbid ADHD. It's only been recognized for the last decade when the DSM-5 came out that both autism and ADHD can co-occur. Even though an autistic person is more likely to have ADHD than someone who is not autistic, and someone with ADHD is more likely to be autistic than someone who does not have ADHD, professionals often only assess for one diagnosis at a time. As talked about in our second episode, with autistic traits not appearing until a person is under the demands of adulthood, the same goes for ADHD. Symptoms may also become more severe when the demands of adulthood increase.
So some symptoms in adults include carelessness and lack of attention to detail, continuously starting new tasks before finishing old ones, poor organizational skills, inability to focus or prioritize tasks, repeatedly losing or misplacing things, forgetfulness, restlessness, difficulty keeping quiet and speaking out of turn, blurting out responses and interrupting others, mood swings and quick temper, inability to cope with stress, extreme impatience, and risk-taking behavior. Today we have two guests, Kirsten and Emily. They are therapists here at Integrative Counseling, where Nicole and I work, and they have ADHD and are going to contribute to answering some questions that we have about the diagnosis. Kirsten, could you say a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name is Kirsten Murren. I'm a licensed social worker. And like you said, I work here at Integrative Counseling Services. And I was diagnosed with ADHD just over 2 years ago, but I knew that I had it for probably a decade before that. But with having ADHD, the process of getting tested for it takes a lot.
Yes.
And it took me a long time to get to the point where I felt that I had to be tested in order to get past it.
And so how old were you, Kirsten, when you were diagnosed?
I was 34, almost 35.
Hi, guys. I'm Emily, and I want to thank you so much for having me. This is a near and dear to my heart subject, so I really appreciate it. And I also work here at Integrative Counseling as a therapist, as a licensed professional counselor. Yeah, it's been a long history my whole life with ADHD, not really knowing I had ADHD and not really being, quote-unquote, formally diagnosed till about 6 years ago, which is, don't make me add or subtract.
I was going to.
No, please. Okay. I'm almost 50. I'm 49. So, yeah, I know I don't look it at all. And thank you. So subtract 49 from six.
I can't do math.
And it might be 43. It might be 6 or 7 years. I'm not 100% sure. But a lot of informal diagnosis, and I don't want to say informal, just, you know, clinicians that I've seen.
And I mean, I just want to say this too. I think that in the age that we're living in, I do think that self-diagnosis is very valid for a variety of reasons. I think that if you don't have the resources financially, or maybe there's just not providers in the area who are, you know, adept at diagnosing adults, you know, if you spend 2 years of your time wondering if you have autism or ADHD, I don't think that you don't have it. I think that if you spend so much time researching, getting to know people's, you know, opinions and perspectives, I think that self-diagnosis definitely does have a place at the table as well.
I totally agree with that. And I think that's why I didn't get diagnosed for as long as I felt that I had it. One of my family members was diagnosed with it, and that's where I started being like, I have those same traits. I have those same symptoms, I guess you could call it. And so I knew that I had it, but just the process of contacting, someone to be tested by them, to contact a doctor, to get referrals, the cost of it, all the dedication to it, I just I have ADHD, so I couldn't do it. It was an obstacle, and I actually had to go to two different doctors. The first one that I went to went through the first part of the COVID testing, and he told me, okay, take this home and do this testing online. And I never did it. And I feel like that is when I definitely knew that I had ADHD. Yes. I feel like that should be the testing. And when it was the embarrassment, the shame, I didn't finish this. I can't go back to that person then. So that's when I contacted another doctor and went through the process. And I told that doctor, I was trying to get tested before. I couldn't complete the online portion of it. And originally she told me, okay, we'll do this today. We'll do the online portion at home, and then you'll come back. She ended up just doing everything in the office that day for me. And I was like, I was wondering, why am I here so long? Yeah. And so it was hours and hours of this. And by the end of it, she was able to, you know, do the formality of the testing. So it was still weeks before I heard that I actually had it. But by the end of the appointment, I asked her, like, do you think I have it? And she said, oh, significantly. And it honestly felt like so such much weight. And she even caught herself. She's like, I shouldn't have said that. I was like, no, thank you. Like, I needed to hear the validation of, okay, for years I thought that I had this.
Yeah.
I've been trying to get tested for it and complete the testing for it. And finally, it was that confirmation.
And I think that's a good point that you make too, Kirsten. Like, if someone listening is, you know, kind of on the fence or going through the process of the testing and they're not completing it, I think that, you know, outright saying that and making sure that the tester is doing all the stuff with you in the office so it gets done.
Definitely.
Could you say more about why that was so validating? You know, so since you suspected that you had it, what was the benefit of getting that weight lifted off your shoulders?
It was saying to me that I knew myself, that I knew what I had, I knew what the diagnosis was, and it wasn't just depression, it wasn't just anxiety that I was diagnosed with for probably well over a decade at that point. Oh, it's depression, it's anxiety, those sprinkling some PTSD. Like, it's always like those three were the ones that I would constantly be told. And these symptoms line up with depression, that you can't get out of bed because you're depressed. You know, you're anxious all the time because of this and that. And just so many reasons for why I had these symptoms, but it was never getting to the root of it. And it was like, I heard that and I was like, oh, finally, there's an explanation for why I am the way that I am. And it really, like, it was only 2 years ago, but it felt so life-changing then.
Yeah, and in that way, I think a lot of neurodivergent diagnoses are similar in the fact that, especially with people getting late diagnosed, Nicole and I have spoken earlier in past episodes about just how much it gives you that explanation of, okay, I'm a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And it's not me. I'm not this unusual, weird person. It's just I'm going through something that I need to understand better.
And it was hard to keep up with life. And like Nicole said earlier, that a lot of symptoms, I've always had these symptoms. I had them since probably elementary school, but fell through the cracks. Never, ever was tested back then. And I was a good student, so and I followed the rules. I was such a rule follower.
Yes. Oh, my God.
I followed the rules. I never got in trouble. I just did what I was supposed to, and it always felt like I'm doing what I'm supposed to. Why is life so hard for me? And college was really difficult then. I never really learned how to study because I could just memorize everything in school, and now it got harder and harder and harder, and work was getting harder and harder. So when I was in my 20s, that's when I was like, okay, this is starting to, you know, there's other information out there. My older sister was diagnosed with ADHD, and that's when things, the puzzle was kind of
clicking.
Coming together. Yeah.
And our stories are very similar until one pivotal turning point. First of all, I was always a good student, always, you know, I actually was kind of quiet when I needed to be, very introverted, and then outrageously extroverted, a lot extra. To this day, that's always been probably, when you talked about the relief, for me it was like, is this why I'm so quote-unquote extra? Is this why I don't walk, if you guys know me, I run.
Yes.
Is this why I'm so loud? Is this why I interrupt? Is this why, you know, and so it all fitting together, but it definitely had to do with, as we know, this is genetic, seeing it in family members and then questioning myself and knowing this was an issue for my sister growing up, not for me, because I was the quiet, good kid who listened and read a lot and paid attention in class. And my sister had, she was a genius, still is, but has had behavioral marks all on the one side of her report card and was, you know, well, what are we going to do with her, you know? And this is a long, this is the 80s, you know, it, there wasn't a lot of options, I guess, back then. So with her, the focus was on her, and I was just kind of the good kid until I, all of it kind of came to a head, and that's where, and this is a huge issue for people who are diagnosed, or not diagnosed, actually, with neural diversity is I fell into addiction at an early age.
Yeah. We're going to talk about that on another episode.
Oh, well, yeah, I'll come back.
You'll be our guest.
Yeah, there you go. That's a long sword story. Woo. But anyway, and so I was the really good kid until I wasn't anymore, you know, because I found a new way to cope, to quiet stuff down temporarily.
Yeah.
To fit in, because my goofiness, mm-hmm. now everybody else is drunk, so Emily fits in.
Yeah.
You know, to smoke a little weed to, oh yeah, okay, now I'm not so. But I actually started more of a search for my nephew, who was having problems at 3 years old, just like my sister. I started doing research and giving her tests and different things. And the next thing I know, I started doing these tests. And I did super fantastic on the executive functioning, I got like the highest score I think you could possibly get, which is that's not a good thing.
Not good.
And so then I, you know, and then I took the RSD test, and then it was like, holy crap. But I sat on it. I was still in early recovery. I was really focusing on my sobriety and stuff like that. So this just took a backseat for a long time.
Yeah.
A long time. And then, you know, going to different therapists and talking about my stuff and being diagnosed with anxiety, being diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, all of these things. And now, finally, when you get that diagnosis, it's like, okay, everybody has trauma. I definitely have anxiety, but holy crap. Yeah. When it came down to it, the big picture.
Yes.
And I'm going to tell you, I wasn't thrilled about it.
Wow.
I wasn't thrilled.
Okay, so Emily just shared, she kind of sat on her diagnosis for a while. And I think that that's a common experience for anyone who is seeking a diagnosis or is diagnosed. And I think that there's a process of grieving, too, that goes on with it. So can each of you share a little bit more about that?
Part of it, for me, I feel like wasn't so much grief. It was the validation. But I do feel like I was grieving the little kid version of me that slipped through the cracks for all those years. You know, I always pictured ADHD as, like, the little boy who was bouncing off the walls. Like, I could remember a specific kid from elementary school. Mm-hmm. That's who I picture as ADHD. So even in my 30s, being diagnosed with it, I still was like, I know that I have it.
You kind of gaslight yourself.
I totally was gaslighting myself. But still, I think you described it as, like, you know, if you're wondering for all this time, like, you probably do have it then.
Yeah.
So that was what it was like for me. So I feel like I didn't grieve too much of it. I think I grieved for the child that I was, and even maybe more so the young adult that I was in college and struggling so much in college and constantly feeling like I was going to just fail in society, basically, and struggling so much. And I just wish that I could have explained to professors when I was in college, to my grad school professors, to say, like, this is why I'm struggling, this is why I'm handing in papers late, but I didn't know that. I thought I was just
flawed.
I was flawed. I wasn't dedicated. I was lazy. And I'm not. I'm stuck. There's oftentimes, and still, even today, like, with knowing this diagnosis, I still get stuck every day. Every single day, I'm fighting against my brain. So I think kind of what Emily was saying before, it's just it was like, okay, my brain is the way that it is. It can't keep up with the societal expectations of you do this, this, and this. You follow the, and like I said, I was a rule follower. I did what I was supposed to. I tried my hardest, and still it would be like, all right, here's this trauma. Here's this issue. Here's this crisis over and over and over again. And it was so difficult to manage that. So I guess that part of it was the grief, but it was the relief also to be like, oh, this is why my brain is this way. It's my brain. And I'm fighting against the way that I am to meet other people's expectations.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you could tell, but there are tears running down my face, not on Harder for Emily, who feels everything.
I'm shocked I'm not crying.
Yeah. Which is part of yeah. who I am, and didn't realize that. Oh God, that's probably the biggest thing I would like to talk about today, not right now. Stick with the question. I have to say what I did, and this is years of going to friends, those I love and trust. That's a big, big, big thing. God love my husband. Do you think I have ADHD? And it didn't matter how many times I got an affirmative. It still, there wasn't a disbelief.
Yep. Yeah.
And maybe, and I know there's a piece of that that is also the hat of the therapist to me. As a therapist, I'm not a huge person who loves DSM diagnosis. I'm like, let's treat symptom. This does not have to define you. It's not all that you are. It can be relief. It can be. So I think I had to take the therapist hat off a little bit too. And all my conflict with medical model, with pathology, and go, Emily, okay, get that hat off and look at yourself as an individual. Mm-hmm. And once I did that, the acceptance was amazing.
Yes. Yeah.
Amazing. Definitely. And just being on something like this to affirm and validate and be with someone like Kirsten, who I adored from day one. You can adore, though. You know who to adore from day one. You know that.
Mutual.
Yeah, we, I don't, and I'm like, oh, I didn't know you had it, but I knew she had it. And like, you know, you just know, you spot each other a mile.
Yeah.
Yes.
But anyway, getting to the feelings part, it's a process indeed. You hear, mine was years, over years. And all these little things, you know, just affirming for myself, oh, remember when this teacher said that, remember when your friends, that you were the entertainer, you were the funny one, and so forth and so on. So the tears that I have expressed today, which I pretty much cry every day, and but it's usually gratitude and love, and then it's gone because that's also ADHD, so I don't stay in any of my feelings. They fly around, and the point is that I definitely felt the loss for that younger person.
Yeah.
Especially my teenage self that started, you know, coping in unhealthy ways.
Right. Yeah.
It was a time when I don't even think, even if I did have a diagnosis, to be honest, I don't know what kind of support I would have had.
Yeah.
So absolutely.
Nicole and I talked a little bit earlier in a past episode about self-image and who identifying like who you are as a person. And it starts as a young age. And I think someone with neurodivergence, without being diagnosed, develops this self-image of feeling like their symptoms are of what they're going through are just who they are, a part of who they are.
Correct.
And it kind of distorts your self-image. But when you get to that point where you get the diagnosis and you finally get that realization that these are not personality traits, these are symptoms. And I just need to learn how to manage them, almost like you would never expect someone with bipolar to not have mood swings or not have depression. In the same way, ADHD and autism, you wouldn't expect people to not have the symptoms that they're going to. But I think there is a lot of misunderstanding about those two diagnoses and how people are expected to handle them.
Definitely. And I think a big part of that is with school and work. Like, it's two of the biggest parts of life is school and work. Everybody needs to get A's. You should get A's. If you're not getting A's, you're not a good student. You're not trying hard enough. You're not studying hard enough. Oh, at your job, like, you have to stay on top of things. If you're getting behind, like, you're flawed. You're not a good person then. So then you have the expectations of everybody else, but the expectations of myself were a million times worse than anything that a professor could say to me, that a boss could say to me. I was beating myself up constantly over what I viewed as, even if it was a very minor thing. Like, I can even remember being in third grade accidentally, like, flinging a pencil. It was very accidental. And I remember my teacher, who I loved, was like, "Kirsten, what are you doing?" And I'm like, "Oh my gosh, I made a mistake." Like, this is, and I hold on to that tiny little thing. Like, I hold on to being perfect, and I'm so not perfect, but I feel like everybody else around me is perfect. Why am I not perfect? So those expectations are so damaging, and I'm still learning to manage that. I definitely am not managing it, but
agreed.
It's hard.
Yeah.
Well, and I think you have a valid point about definitive diagnosis is it. Again, this is still work in progress for me too. I have to say that,
sure.
Just because of some of my beliefs around diagnosis. Yeah. So I have to say though, but I, you know, maybe it took this for me to even be a better clinician in the fact that I can understand, mm-hmm. You know, the relief that can come from it, the understanding that can come from it. But I would be the kid who would fling the pencil. And
it truly was accidental for me.
But the idea of going back to what I think you were trying to say, you feel so different. Mm-hmm. Like the intensity of that difference. And for someone, even though it's the DSM, and or a, you know, trained clinician and or a test to finally say, you're not different. You fall into a category. And there's a lot of you out there.
Yeah.
And a lot of formality, but talking to people that know you.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to people that know you and love you. They know you better than anybody, even when you don't know yourself.
Exactly.
You might know yourself, but these people see you all the time. And it affects them because it affects relationships.
Definitely.
And I think there's a, you know, there's a thing like good or bad, like am I better or worse? But I think that sometimes it's the word different is overlooked. Like, you know, you just learn differently. You think differently. And that's not a bad thing or a good thing. It's just that your brain operates in a different way. And I think that getting that diagnosis really normalizes or really starts you on the path of normalizing that sentiment that, there's nothing wrong with me. I just happen to think a little bit differently and maybe need Correct. To learn a little bit differently than the average person.
Yeah.
It's funny because even hearing that now, like, I've never thought of myself as different. Like, I still have been like, all right, you act this way. Your brain thinks this way. So you just I have to figure out hacks. I have to figure out ways to manage this. But, like, I never even thought of it. Yeah, I'm different. And it's okay to be different,
and
of
that's
course.
Okay,
yeah. But it's also hard, I think, because of just the societal pressures of, like, it's we hear it's okay to be different,
yes.
but
the expression is different.
That's it.
Right.
It's like, well, you're going to fail out of college and because you're not doing this correctly, or, you know, the expectations of are still the standard.
Yep.
So it's definitely okay to be different. And I'm hoping that we're moving in that direction of, like, understanding, like, how to make it more manageable and for
inclusive. Life to be,
exactly,
yeah.
Very much more inclusive in the future for so many different reasons. But yeah, I'm literally right now, I'm like, I'm different. Like, it's like a light bulb.
I know exactly what you mean. Because on a previous episode, I was saying how when I was going through my diagnosis, I was reading a book, and the book is really what pointed out, like, oh, wait, like, these aren't normal things. And, like, I would have never thought until I, like, read that book, because to me it's so normalized. Like, this is my life. This is how I act. And this is how I've always been. So yes. It's so weird to think, like, other people aren't like me.
Yeah, yeah. It shocks me still that people could just get up, have their breakfast, brush their teeth, shower. Like, I have to be like, put your feet on the floor.
Yeah.
Walk downstairs.
Oh, my God.
Skip breakfast because I really don't have the energy and the drive to complete that task. Like, that sounds like too much because, oh, I do have to shower. That's going to take more energy.
Energy.
Like, it blows my mind that people can just have a routine
live
and
life,
not have to think of the routine.
Yeah.
My routine is so meticulous, and
planned
I don't
out.
Follow it. I do not follow it. But I try, and with the planners and everything,
mm-hmm.
like, it. I should be, like, the most stellar, organized person ever, and I am not. But I can't wrap my head around that other people who maybe are the norm, and I'm using, you know, air quotes for that,
yeah.
Can just do those things. Like, I have never been able to do that, and it was pretty recent. I feel like, what, you know, within the last 2 years of being diagnosed, that that I learned that people can just have that autopilot to live their life, where every single step of mine is taken. Like, the only time I'm on autopilot is if I feel like I'm driving, basically. Like, that's the one time that I zone out, but, like, carefully zone out. But otherwise, I'm calculating every single step that I'm taking. And it's exhausting. I feel burnt out nearly every day, if not every single day.
Every day.
Yes.
Every day.
I'm definitely minimizing it. It is every day. And it's that's it. It's just exhausting.
Well, and to go back to the word different, I think it's, you guys, we're all therapists. So, you know, when you hear that client say a word and you're like, no, I want to stay with that. I want to stay with that word. Mm-hmm. It's so funny. You really hit the nail on the head, Kirsten, when you were talking about, for me, and here's the funny thing, I always liked myself. No, wait, there's a caveat. Always. I thought I was fun. I do think I'm fun. Thank you. I am very fun. I'm funny. I've been described in a lot of affirmative ways of, like, you know, the sunshine in the room, the brightness, the, you know, and this is something I want to get into today, the positives and a whole new look on, you know, different ways to look at ADHD, which is what I really focus on with my clients once they process, but to not always look at, and I hate the word deficit, we'll get into that as well, but to really, you know, I liked who I was. It was everything you said. I didn't fit in my mind in the societal expectations. I didn't fit in my mind in the peer group expectations. I didn't fit in my mind in romantic relationships. I didn't fit in my mind. Well, I fit pretty damn good with my family because everybody's. But anyway, so, you know, but that was the tough part. To this day, you know, I'm okay with having, like, a 3 hour in the morning, like, God only knows what I get up to. I drink a hell of a ton of coffee, but I'm okay with a lot of these things. It's just the pressures of society, work, school. I can't even talk about school without getting anxious.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I can't even talk traumatic. About school without, absolutely. So it was all of that. But in essence, the whole time, I was struggling against that as opposed to, you know, internally really liking who I was, but the negative beliefs about myself were formulated on the mm-hmm. expectations of all the external, not the internal.
Yeah.
When I am working with clients, I really try to hyper-focus on the superpowers that this is and can be once they're at that point.
You know, you start with this neurotypical belief system hammered into you from kindergarten, even you know, you have to handle, you know, listen a certain way and process things a certain way. And, you know, it makes you, it gets you in this mindset of such a young age that if I don't fit this mold, not going to go anywhere. And it's a very depressing feeling. And I think that's where you mentioned maybe that grief feeling comes in, you know, just for that person who felt like, man, I just felt so lost.
I was able to, I guess, mask in elementary school, all the way through high school, I think. When it came to education, I was able to float through, get good grades. College is where it was like, whoa, I don't know how to do this. Like, that's where really, like, things started, like, firing off for symptoms for me. Being in friend groups, I always felt like I was in with the crowds I wanted to be in, but I felt like the outsider of those crowds. I was always the one who was like, I don't have this, and I don't have that, and I can't do this, and I'm not thinking that way. Like, I definitely felt, like, different. Didn't think of that until just now, but very, very much felt that way in those years between probably early elementary, definitely through high school. Had great friend groups, but just always felt like I'm the odd one here. I don't fit in. I'm in, but I don't fit in with it.
Looking in.
Exactly, exactly. And I always would, like, I'd pick up on things that people were saying but not saying. It was hard. It was stressful being a kid, basically, and a teenager, definitely, a young adult, and here I am now in my 30s where it is kind of like falling into place, but where I feel like for other people it would fall into place when they were like 18, 19. Like, I think I'm a teenager. I'm literally going to be 37 in a week. And I am like, I'm 16. Mm-hmm. I'm a 16-year-old. Yep. So,
I act like a teenager every day. So, but that's the fun part about ADHD.
Yes, and you know what? And I have to frame it as that. Yeah. That I can feel young. So, mm-hmm. I'm young.
You are young.
Someone's young. So, I won't go on that tangent. 18 is great. So, I love that you said that, Emily, because I need to frame it that way. I definitely still have this, I have to manage this, I have to get past this, and I don't want to feel that way. I want to feel like, this is me. I struggle with things, but this is me, and there mm-hmm. are great things about it, because I can pick up on a person's personality very mm-hmm. quickly, if they're fake, if yep. they're being
intuitive,
honest,
you are.
Intuitive, extremely yes. intuitive. And I think that's why I felt like I couldn't fit in all the time, because I was like, why do you all like this person?
Yeah,
they're terrible.
Yep.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Definitely. Yep. And I think I'm not falling for the traps that people set a lot of times.
Yeah.
And I do think that's a really good trait of mine, but I never thought of it that way. Yeah.
But it is. It's all about perspective for me, you know? And when I was ready, again, we know this, you have to go through the process in order to get the perspective. There are days I still have to process.
Yes.
Because I go a little bit like, ooh, you know, doing this podcast became a process. Feeling a little, you know.
Vulnerable,
mm-hmm. loss. Yeah, all the things you guys are bringing up and talking about. But I could talk for hours on the superpowers of what ADHD is.
I need you to be my therapist to do that. And I have a great therapist, but I need that.
I mean, intuitive, unbelievable. And that, I believe, makes us great clinicians.
Definitely.
I feel everything. And so when I'm in there, yep. it's not about me, it's about the client, but I feel everything for them. Yep. They know that. Yep. They feel that. Yep. They see that. You know, yes, I go through feelings in 2 seconds flat. That gives me great boundaries as a therapist, because I will feel so intently and strong for you. I will have tears in my eyes for you.
Yeah.
And then when you leave,
yes.
it's over.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because I don't carry it. And mm-hmm. I know others, you know, therapists struggle with that personalization.
Yeah.
I can't. Yeah. I can't hold on to a feeling longer than 2 seconds. It's gone. Yeah. Thank God.
Yeah.
And I think that helps for clients to have them open up more then, because I've had clients say, I don't want to put this on you. You know, this is too much. I'm like, I'm good. It's good. I
close
the door. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of the sessions I do are virtual. When I close the window of that, all right, on to the next one.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah.
And some stuff sticks with me, of course.
True.
But I feel like I could process it quickly, and it doesn't become too daunting for me to do this type of job. So I do feel like we can be good clinicians in that way.
The one thing it does is, like you said, the exhaustion. But that is separate from the feelings. Yes. That's just because it's a lot of work, energy. Mm-hmm. Everything I do, I can only speak for myself, is a lot of energy expelled.
Yes. Yeah.
Because it's intense. Everything I do is a 10. On a level of, and to ask my husband how many appliances I break and how loud I am around the house and how many songs I make up about my animals and how many air guitars I play when I'm vacuuming, and like, it's just insane. So it's intense. So I give that same intensity with each client.
Yeah.
So so it can be exhausting, but it's not a personalization, and that is a great boundary for me. So the creativity. Holy crap.
Yes.
I mean, and come on, in a session with somebody, people are like, okay, I use this theory. And I'm like, dude, I'm just there. And when I'm there, it's like, boom, 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 boom.
I don't know what this is called, but I'm doing it.
Yeah, I don't even know. And the ideas. I have a drawer full of, and I have like 4 books started, and I have a drawer full of all these ideas of inventions and creations and book ideas and, you know, and. Now, do I follow through with any of that?
That's okay. We'll get you a publisher.
Yeah. That's the caveat. Again, there's always the, you know, I can go on and on and on. There are so many, for me, superpowers of this. Again, I just think I'm trailing off. I'm going to try to stay centered, but I'll never forget this. It was, this was a pivotal moment in my ADHD in reflection. I'm a huge reader. It's the one thing I can't hyper-focus at. I know that's difficult actually for a lot of people with this, but I was reading Interview with the Vampire. Anne Rice, the author, was writing about this transition into being a vampire. Yes, I'm talking about vampires on this podcast. When she was describing it, it was very vivid. This transformation, this individual who was changing into the vampire, seeing everything in bright colors, was noticing everything. I remember reading this book and going, that's how I see the world. That's how I see the world. And going, oh my God, dude, I do have a superpower.
Yeah.
Didn't know it was ADHD.
Yeah.
But I'm, but I can.
When that dopamine hits.
Yeah.
It's the best feeling.
If I'm like in the woods, it's like boom, boom, boom. All the, like right this time of year, the trees, the leaves, the bees in the background. Because it's not a deficit of attention. It's I can pay attention to everything.
Yes.
And it is mind blowing. And the detail and the beauty and the, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's just honing it in and controlling it.
Yes, exactly. I try to be creative. I love being creative. I don't stick with it, but I'm trying to like recognize, all right, this is, you know, this is my deficit, another air quote, is that it's hard for me to stick with things. But my goodness, if I'm just like, I want to paint that. I want to learn embroidery. I want to, you know, I want to read, you know, this really long book.
Yep.
Easy. I could learn how to do something so easily and be creative, and it is such a good outlet for me, and I feel it so much more, and especially when it's like new and exciting and I'm good at it the first time that I do it. That's a whole other thing. If it takes me a while, I'm like, well, I'm not perfect at this, so I'm going to drop this habit or drop this hobby that I'm picking up now. But exactly that. Like if it's new, if it's like exciting.
Exactly.
It's like, I can't get enough of this. But when things become the same thing over and over and over again.
Bored.
Exactly.
I am bored all day, every day, 24 hours a day. If I don't constantly have new experiences.
Yeah.
I have to romanticize
everything. Oh my God. I love that.
I was just going to say, I love it. That.
It's so fun. It's the funnest thing ever.
It really is.
And I'm really glad you guys are pointing out the strengths of ADHD. Cause it came to my mind, like that's what this podcast is really all about is celebrating neurodivergence and it can create challenges. Like you both said, like, you know, it can create challenges, but it also has these amazing gifts with it. And it's all about kind of harnessing the gifts while learning to overcome the deficits in a way that is like the most efficient, productive, healthy way that you can live your life. And yeah, that's what we're really trying to do. You guys are really giving some good insight into that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's me. I'm always positive.
You're so insightful and positive.
Oh my God. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
So I'm going to go off of what you were saying about, you know, I want to talk about like misconceptions. What are some other misconceptions that you guys have, you know, come across?
Well, and I think it starts off with it is the little boy in the classroom, you know, acting out. Let's go back to just the difference in gender.
Yes.
You know, I mean, that's huge.
Yeah.
I was a little girl who was, you know, I wasn't always quiet, but I could stay quiet.
Yeah.
Because I could follow the rules because the RSD, I want, well, that's a whole nother.
Yes.
I wanted, I didn't want anybody to be angry with me. I wanted to be the good girl. I wanted to, you know, so I could do that. I could hold it in. So I think the misconception that, you know, a lot of underdiagnosed individuals are female for the sheer fact that it doesn't look, maybe you don't see the behaviors as much.
Yeah. I've heard the term acting in instead of acting out.
Exactly.
And that is what I did. I internalized everything.
Yep.
It created the shame and embarrassment, like something's wrong with me. So I acted inward instead of being, you know, instead of flinging my pencil on purpose or being, you know, acting out and no behavioral issues ever because everything was internal. It was in my brain that my brain was attacking me basically. It felt like that I was just having this struggle every single day. And so I think that is that big misconception. Like when I told people that I was diagnosed with ADHD, a lot of people were like, "No,
they
you don't."
Oh God! Yeah. Of course.
What? Like you're so all the masks that I put up that make it seem like I have my life together. And so I definitely had the misconception right in my face that like I'm not that little boy bouncing off the walls in elementary school. I was definitely the one, you know, holding everything in. And I think I mentioned before, like, there's the paralysis that comes with ADHD, and I feel stuck. I'll say I'm glued. I'm glued to the couch. Yeah. I'm glued to the bed. I can't get up and do the things that I want to do. I want to do these things. I just cannot
see
do
that's
them.
Interesting. I can't get glued anywhere.
Oh, I wish that was
and which is sometimes why it's picked up a little bit more on, you know, even though I was young and I was able to keep it together. As an adult, you all know me. Yeah. As I started to become more authentic, I'd use that word, Brandon, you know. As I became more authentic, I just had to stop caring as much. And let me give you a little clue too, guys. As you get older, you don't care as much.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful feeling. It really is. It's a beautiful thing.
I feel like I'm on the cusp of that. I can't wait.
it really is. It really is a beautiful thing.
I want to go back to something that Kirsten had mentioned earlier about how, you know, a memory stuck with her from third grade. And I think that that's something to be said. I think that, you know, if these instances where you feel, you know, judged or criticized, they leave an imprint on you. And I think that, you know, being autistic or having ADHD, I think we go through so much of our life having so many of those little experiences, and they just add up and add up and add up and add up. And then that, you know, hits our self-esteem. So something that is commonly experienced in ADHD and autism as well is rejection-sensitive dysphoria. So that's a problem that interferes with your ability to regulate your emotional responses to feelings of failure and rejection. This is something that folks with autism can also experience, like I said, and neurotypical people can experience this as well. And I'm also going to attach a self-screening tool in the description of this episode if anyone wants to check that out. But I wanted to talk a little bit more to Emily about her experience with rejection-sensitive dysphoria.
Said it earlier that I actually found out what RSD was through Attitude Magazine, which is a great resource,
it
by
is
the
great,
way.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of this, I can give you lots of resources on the matter. But it is a great resource. Easy to read, a lot of self-tests, a lot of everything, updated research. So you know, it is a great resource. But anyway, it's where I first realized this, again, another aha moment that I put on the back burner and said, I don't know. And again, I think for me, it was the big word of this is a deficit. This is something, you know, blah, 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 that I didn't like. And therefore I didn't want to think of myself. But like you said, Nicole, I think, and I could be wrong here, but I think it's like the average child at the age of 12 that has ADHD hears like 20,000 negatives about themselves at that point. So, you know, and that's just what other people say.
Not even their own.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not the internal voice that Kirsten was alluding to so much, you know. So it is that internal voice that gets, you know, manifested, whether self or from externals, you know. And so for me, it was people pleasing is huge. I guess I am my own harshest critic, of course. Needing to prove myself is a big one.
Same.
Who the hell am I proving myself to? I think that all the time. Like, you know, even with this podcast, I'm like, I need to be prepared.
Yeah.
I need to be able to, you know, it can be, that is the exhausting part.
Yes. It is.
You know, that is it the is. Exhausting part. I need to prove myself. And for me, and here is one, because they're without a doubt are positives and negatives. Here's a negative that sticks with me. And this is one I am trying to navigate and will, I'm sure, continue to navigate. Social aspects. The RSD comes with, I need to trust people.
Yeah.
Because I feel easily embarrassed. Mm-hmm. Because I am hypersensitive.
Yeah. Yep.
Because my brain works differently. So, you know, it's a twofold. It's a whammy. My brain works differently, and, you know, my frontal lobe isn't like yours, so therefore, you know, are you going to understand me? And here's the thing, not that you have to. Mm-hmm. That's something I've had to work on, too. It's, you know, just one of those things of, this is a diagnosis for my understanding, and I hope through podcasts like this, research, the wonderful doctors that I read about that are getting information out there that the world will get better with understanding.
Yeah.
But until that time, I have to work on myself and what I can control. And sometimes, a lot of times, that is my environment. And in order to maintain a level of protection for myself with RSD, I am very picky and choosy about friendships and about who I interact with. Mm-hmm. And so I don't have a lot of quote-unquote acquaintances. I have a trusted, loving partner who I could just go on and on and on. And if we talk about relationships, I will talk about him. my favorite person in the world. I have a sister who understands this really well. And so I have her, and she's my bestie. I have a couple good friends who have actually helped me come to this conclusion, and they are my soulmates. They are intimate relationships. That's what I have. Mm-hmm. When it comes to larger society, I'm not good at talking about something unless I'm super interested in it anyway. So it's, you know, take me to a wedding. It's the one time I will take an Adderall because it's really hard for me.
Sure.
Really hard for me. Because I just, it's oh my God, am I going to say the wrong thing? Oh my God. Because I say a lot.
Yeah.
And then when I'm nervous, you quadruple that.
Oh, absolutely.
And since I haven't had a drink in 20 years to take the edge off, you know, even more so. So, you know what I mean? I can't toke the weed in the back. I can't in the bathroom. I can't, you know, it's a lot different. So I'm very conscious of my environment because of it too. So,
Definitely. And kind of what Nicole was saying about, school for me, like I could probably think of something that happened in every single grade of like, I hold on to it decades later of just these mistakes. Like they weren't even like, I'm sure the teacher didn't even think about it at the end of her day. And I'm, you know, decades later still thinking about the time that I flung the pencil or opened the door when I wasn't supposed to. Like I could probably think of every single grade. That is something that I can't wait to kind of grow out of and stop caring. Yeah. Like, what everyone thinks about me. I am constantly looking at myself from the lens of other people, not myself. Because oftentimes I don't like the lens that I view myself in because of just that perfection and not meeting that perfection. So I'm constantly looking at like, all right, what was that person's tone? And it's all subconsciously. It's not like I'm literally being like, what was their tone with me? I'm just like automatically thinking about, what was their tone with me? Are they mad at me? My poor husband.
Yeah, I know. Our poor husbands, yeah.
Kind of like to link into the relationship part of it. I always am like, are you mad at me? Are you mad at me? And he never is. He never is mad at me. And sometimes I think it's jokingly say like, I get mad when you ask that question because it probably does get to be annoying when he's totally fine. He's not upset about anything. But he's, you know, irritated by something else. Probably not even irritated by anything, but the vibe feels off.
Yeah,
and I think, I caused this. It was me. I did this wrong thing, whatever that perpetual wrong thing is. And so it's in my own relationship. It's with family members and friends. You know, it goes into coworkers. Like, every relationship that I have feels hard for me, but wonderful at the same time. Like, what you were saying, like, I feel the value of the relationships that I have, but I'm always feeling like I have to walk on eggshells with everything that I say, every person that I'm with, even if it's somebody, you know, my husband and I have been together for 9 years now, and I'm still like, oh, is he going to leave me? Like, is he going to get mad at me about something? I don't think he's going to, but that feeling is there, and with friendships then too, like I feel like I have to be checking in on people enough or not be too overwhelming that I'm, you know, checking in too much. Like it's, the balance is really hard for me and I'm trying to get there. And I feel like I'm on the cusp of just not caring anymore. And I really can't wait for that exhaustion to go away, hopefully with that, like, or at least just a break from it. Cause it feels like if I get a text and I'm reading the tone the wrong way, or it's a one word answer, I'm like, oh, that person's mad at me. They're, you know, they're upset with something I did or didn't do. And I'm constantly having to keep up with the relationship with myself, with my partner, with family, friends, even an acquaintance. I'm like, is that going to turn into a friendship? Like, am I going to have that person be in my life that I could have a support from? And it's a lot.
It's exhausting.
Everything is so exhausting.
It is.
But I promise, and I say this to clients too. I say, you know, I'm not gonna. I try to be really genuine. I say, you know, if and when I do disclose, with them, which, you know, again, only for their benefit, yeah. never for mine, of yeah. course. But, you know, the freedom and the empowerment piece there that comes with that when you do. There are definitely things that I'm still working on, for sure. But the RSD is something I think, once I figured that out, mm-hmm. I have been working intently on that, that I matter enough that not everybody needs to be my friend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Other people's opinion of me doesn't really matter. Yeah. Not everybody sees the world the way I do, but the way I see it is unbelievable, yeah. you know? And so things like that have helped me. So I, for as much as I used to years and years ago make so much fun of affirmations, I am a big affirmer daily. I do it all day long. And especially if something does come up, like you said, Kirsten, where I'm in that situation where I'm doing the inventory check with myself. Yes, did I do this?
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
yeah, I go right to an affirmative. I go right to an affirmative, you know? No, Emily, you know? And but if it is something that I need to correct that I still need to work on, I look at that too. Okay, how could I, you know, okay, yes, I'm still blurting stuff out in the middle of conversations. Mm-hmm. How can I do a little bit better there?
Yep. I think the common theme here, though, is we keep our, you know, circles really small and intimate and, you know, very quantity over quality, I think. And so, you know, as far as romantic relationships or even, you know, friendships, how do you find it is, you know, having ADHD and keeping up with these relationships and friendships?
I could say, and I've been with my husband for about 29 years, and there have been so many ups and downs, and I can see how so much of that roller coaster was correlated one way or another with ADHD, right? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, we're in a phenomenal place now. I think, you know, it's just like anything else, taking time, having supports, feeling safe. I would go back to that sense of safety in your environment. There's a doctor who I love, and I read a lot of his stuff, Edward Hallowell. Great, 40 years he's been in talking about ADHD, Harvard professor. He has it himself, which is always, you know, how much we could respect that. It's wonderful, and he always makes these two statements. If you have ADHD, if you have the right job, and the right partner,
yes,
you're going to succeed. Yeah. And I've definitely found the right job, you know. and yeah. I've definitely found the right partner. You know, they talk about the honeymoon phase. I think it's, you know, 8 months and all those good chemicals are rushing through your brain. And, you know, you're so madly in love and you feel on top of the world. Good news, I feel that every day.
Aww.
And it's because of, I really, truly believe it's because of my little frontal lobe there. Because I feel everything. Yes. So when that man walks into the room, when my husband walks into the room, I get butterflies. Mm-hmm. It doesn't die out. However, he does not have ADHD. So I cannot always expect the same feelings and response in return.
Yep.
You know, there was a lot of navigation. I can't get into it. It's just there's so much navigating along the way. Him understanding who I am. Him not trying to redirect, parent me. Because that has happened. And that were a lot of arguments in the past. But now it's more supportive. This morning he texted me. My husband's, he's in the South. He's not even in the same state as us right now for work. And he texted me this morning, just letting you know, the marathon is today, so if you want to get to work, maybe take this street and that street. And I go, I don't know those streets. Can you give me landmarks? And he goes, Emily, the one is one block away from where you work. And I go, oh, I don't know. That was him supporting me. It wasn't him. Uh-huh. And I started to realize he's a grounder for me in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
You know, I found the yin to my yang. I'm all about balance. I don't think we found each other by accident for a million reasons. But I know for a fact that he balances me out. Anyway, it has been a lot of navigation as far as having a romantic relationship. But I do think, again, I'm going to go with the age thing and the time. It has helped us tremendously. And now we really do kind of revolve around each other in a really healthy way.
Yeah, that's great. I feel like I relate to a lot of that, too, with my husband. Very supportive and that quote of like finding the right job and the right partner, I think that makes so much sense to me, because I can't imagine being in the type of job where it was the same thing every day, or you knew what to expect every day. And but with my partner, with my husband, I do like to know what to expect every day. Like, we have just a very balanced relationship. Like, he takes care of me in a lot of ways. And
yeah.
And I that's one of the things that I don't always like about myself, that if I forget about something, if I need more support than I think I deserve, it really gets to me sometimes. But I do think that, like, I can balance that for him as well, where I can't just be like, here's my idea, let's do this. And sometimes if my ideas don't go according to plan, he's the one to be like, not everything has to be perfect, it's okay. So I think that we both can be fun and have that, like, balanced, you know, quality relationship. And I'll be honest, like, relationships that I had before him felt pretty balanced as well. Like, I, you know, thankfully, like, I wouldn't say I was ever in, like, a toxic relationship ever, which I know is not, it's not always the case. The area that I probably work the most in is domestic violence and just unhealthy relationships. It's the area that I, oddly enough, gravitate towards the most of my work. But I luckily have had always, you know, people in my life that could be supportive. And that was, you know, well before that I was diagnosed. Like, the only time that when I was diagnosed was, obviously it was 2 years ago. And so I was with my husband at the time, but he knew
for many years. I said, they always know. Yeah, right?
It's like when we be dating, I'm like, oh, you can't come in my apartment, it's a mess. Like, we'll just go out. We'll go to your place. Like, but I think that was a hard thing to learn, to let myself be seen for for who I am. That I can be messy. There's dishes in the sink. Sometimes if the dishes pile, like, he's the one doing them, even though I'm the one causing it. And so it is nice to, like, have that person that's not shaming. I never feel shame from him. I never feel, I think I do feel embarrassed because I'm just like, oh, this is me. And it's embarrassing to have these traits, but he never makes me feel that way. So I think having the right partner, being at the least toxic as possible in a relationship, having a strong, healthy relationship does help a lot. I know that's not the case for everybody though. I feel like, sadly, I think it's the case for most people that not to be the situation, or just not having the understanding of it. Maybe it helps with being a therapist that I can explain things in certain ways. Like, if I wasn't a therapist, if I had a totally different career, maybe I wouldn't have this understanding and couldn't explain, you know, some of the things that I felt or experienced, or, you know, just was part of who I was. So I'm not sure. I think that may be, like, an interesting, you know, thing to look into a little bit more, is to see, like, what, you know, how, you know, this, we might just be the two lucky people who have healthy relationships.
Well, honestly, there's a book, and I don't know how long it came out, but it's called ADHD is Awesome. And I love this book. It is, look at me giving them a shout out here.
Yeah.
It's the Holdernesses. It's this couple that wrote this book together. The husband, Penn Holderness, has ADHD, and his wife, Kim, writes a lot in the book and her experience. So it's really interesting. They have a podcast. They have I think they won the Amazing Race or something like that. Yeah, well, because he has ADHD, so they can't. So, yeah, but it really gets into kind of the trials and tribulations, but the understanding and the love that's there. So there's a lot of couples out there too, but they are a really good example if anybody's looking for good reading material to understand a little bit more of not just ADHD, but the relational part of it.
And I think, like, it's so interesting that, like, you have all these resources and you have looked into all that, where I definitely have taken more of, like, I'm avoiding all this. I don't want to learn this. And I don't know why. I don't know what the reason is for that. I think it's been a comfort to me to not know some of the things. I think because if I could put a reason for something, sometimes it makes me uncomfortable, or I don't want to know. I just want to, you know, be in my own world and get the support that I want to a certain extent. But I think it probably would be good for me to branch out a bit more and read more about it and learn about, you know, other people who have ADHD.
Well, you get a lot of different I wouldn't say opinions, but perspectives.
Yeah.
You know, if I didn't read on Edward Holloway, would have never, I'm not even going to bring it up, but he has a whole different way of even calling it ADHD. He calls it VAST.
Oh, I got to look into
interesting.
That.
Interesting.
Variable, I think, attention. Oh, crap. I don't know. But it's
already I'm like, yes, that's
yes,
what it varies.
Yes, it's a different, that's not way. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's everything evolves.
Yes.
This yeah. diagnosis will evolve.
Yes.
You know, you guys having this podcast to talk about it, it will evolve.
Yes.
And it can become an empowering thing. That is my thing. The yeah. more I'm educated, this is the fact, the more I read, the more I am empowered.
Exactly.
And so that is why I do a lot of this, is for my own personal empowerment. And then who am I? I don't ever want to be with a client, do as I say, not as I do. Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
So when I go in there, I can't just focus on the problem. I need to tell them that, hey, listen, this happened to, this is me, you know, and there's a solution too. That is if I just self-disclose. But at least to let them know, because there's always a solution. Yeah. You know, there's always a solution.
Yeah. I definitely have to branch more out into that because I, oddly enough, I feel like this has been very therapeutic
right?
for me. Yeah. To like talk about this and connect with people.
And just to say one more thing about neurodivergent relationships, in my experience too, I have my fiance has ADHD, and I could be generalizing, but I think that the path in neurodivergent relationships can get rocky and can get really difficult to gain that understanding of each other and what you're going through. But I think in a lot of ways that once you get to that point of healthiness and of understanding, that you can really have a passionate, genuine, just wonderful relationship. And I want to thank Kirsten and Emily so much for coming on. We really, really enjoyed your insights and the conversation, and I just think you guys did a great job of just kind of letting everyone know what it's like to have ADHD and how awesome it can be and how to cope with things. And so thanks for tuning in to Spectrum Sessions today. We hope today's conversation illuminated the various experiences of individuals with autism and ADHD. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe and share it with others who might find it helpful. Until next time, stay curious, stay kind, and keep celebrating what makes you unique.